Welcome, folks. Welcome. Left Reckoning. I'm Matt Leck. With me, David Griscom. Hello, David. It's Left Reckoning 93.
Yeah, man. I just realized we're only a few away from 100.
After a hundo.
I know. It's pretty nuts, right?
Crazy. Yeah, tonight, jam-packed show. To culminate the night, I'll go in reverse order. We have Ryan Zickraff unearthing some Tennessee labor history. Want to stick around for that. Also, got Nick from the Debt Collective on to talk about what the hell's going on with the student loan relief stuff, with all the legal trolls we got in this country.
That's fair, in the way of
executive action on that matter. So we got an update on one of the darker parts of American society with regards to its treatment of tribal nations. In between that. So
no, it's got a pretty jam packed show. And before we jump into this, the first story, Matt. We also have a fun bonus episode coming up this weekend because we haven't talked because we're part of the liberal establishment that is protecting FTX from. Because we've been getting money and we've been cozying up to them. But Matt and I are bucking that tradition this weekend with our guest promoting their new book.
Jacob Silverman, it's funny because I wasn't going to talk to him about crypto. I originally reached out because I wanted him to talk to us about his new piece in the New Republic on David Slack and the crypto, the libertarian, the tech libertarians. But I mean, I think we all know that these have significant crossovers. So we'll be
they're swimming in the same pool. Yeah.
Have you seen the Andreessen Horowitz, a 16Z, you might have seen this handle on Twitter, but they're all over helping Elon, like Jason Calacanis is helping these guys. And hey, you know, there might be so many fascinating features that $8 seems like a bargain. It's all the same NFT hucksters that we all know and despise.
So patrons, you can sign up for that, patreon.com/leftreckoning. You'll get access to that on Sunday. But man, I mean, talking about hucksters and online and Elon Musk, people have been following, I'm sure, the trash fire that has been Twitter since Elon Musk has taken over that company. I was saying to Matt, or I might have even said it on the show, that you know, the one good thing about him taking over Twitter is that for many people who might not follow, you know, business news or things like that very closely, it's their first experience with an Elon Musk company, and seeing how he runs things, I think, has probably not been very, very good for his public persona. And he's been tweeting up a storm, you know, from doing things like mouthing off to Senator Markey, publicly harassing and firing employees. But you know one thing he's not been talking about, Matt? Some very bad news for him and very good news for working people that came out of Austin, Texas earlier today. Right here in Austin, there were two filings today with the Federal Department of Labor over worker abuse at one of Musk's factories in Del Valle. The Workers' Defense Project has filed on behalf of multiple workers, two violations in particular. One, the number one capitalist scam of all time, unpaid wages and unpaid overtime. And at least one worker at this facility was given fake OSHA certification. And we have some more up here if you want to pull up this graphic. This is from Gus Bovin, the Texas Observer. The title of the piece, you should read it, Elon Musk's Tesla Gigafactory.
Elon Musk's
Tesla Gigafactory built on wage theft and safety violations Texas workers allege. And if you go down the piece, you know, it's a good recap of a lot of these different violations. But reminding folks that back in summer of 2020, as Elon Musk was deciding to move Tesla headquarters to Texas, seemingly in protest of California COVID-19 restrictions, the Travis County Commissioner's Court approved a deal worth $14 million in property tax rebates for the Gigafactory. And I'll put a link in the show notes, too. People should listen to our interview with Bob Leibel, who ran here for the Travis County Commissioner's Court. You know, that deal is actually, even worse than just that top line number that you're seeing there. But the deal included some friendly labor terms, such as a $15 an hour wage floor. But it didn't include all the terms outlined in the so-called Better Builder Program, the signature initiative of workers' defense that for years has raised the floor on wages and safety for construction projects receiving government incentives in Central Texas. In particular, the deal lacked independent on-site monitoring of safety and wage payment, according to Workers' Defense Policy Director David Chinkanchin. When Workers' Defense first learned about Tesla coming to Travis County and seeking tax incentives, we opposed the project, given the history of labor and employment abuses on Tesla sites across the nation, David Chinkankin said Tuesday. When the final deal included some worker protections, it was not the level of protections that the community wanted. And I just want to say it right here, you know, because I remember when Musk ended up coming to Austin, the Austin area, you know, people were very excited, right? It felt because there's a big and very embarrassing for a lot of cities, mine included, kind of wooing campaign for him. And I think some people sort of saw it as like recognition of Austin being a sort of hub for industry, finance, and tech. But Musk didn't come here because he likes the food or because he likes the people, the culture, the weather, etc. He came here for the same reason he brought SpaceX here, because he thought that Texans were rubes and that he could get away with abusing the land and working people here. He came here because he thought that the government would be much, much more friendly to his form of money-making than the government of California. And I think it's really important to remember that as we see things like what's happened at the Tesla Gigafactory here, as we see things like he's done in South Texas, not just to the people who live there, but to the land, the very clear disrespect for that part of the country. Musk came here because he thought he could get away with stuff. He ran away from California. Yes, because he didn't want COVID-19 workers' protections. It's important to remember what restrictions he was worried about, protections for working people, but also because he was facing serious allegations of, I don't know how else to say it, but extreme racism and workers' abuse at the Fremont facility in California. He's running away from basic workers' protections in California and thinking he can get away with this kind of stuff here in Texas.
Yeah, I mean, it's all cute for it to pretend like it's just the COVID stuff, which, by the way, using COVID as leverage to increase workplace safety and compensation is good. But Elon, yeah, the Fremont factory had a developed culture of racism to the point where, like, proper nouns, name of stations, like, I mean, I don't want to say any, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean,
I mean, look it up.
We're about like trying to put these things out there, but we said it once on this program and like don't feel like saying them again, right?
Yeah,
exactly. That's how I generally feel about it, but you should check out our video on that as well if you haven't seen it. I mean, it's pretty egregious and nasty. You know, on top of that too, it's not just the racism, it's just general workers' abuse.
I mean, racialized like hierarchy as far as who does what jobs.
Yeah.
You know, like the ultimate, like one of the original justifications of racism and
regular union busting. And as you're seeing from his very public performance about how he treats his Twitter employees, just a very abusive culture across the board. And what happened here is really egregious, right? So the unpaid wages, but the safety as well. If you want to go over to this next slide, this is directly from the filing. It's from the filing on behalf of the workers from the Workers' Defense Project. One of the things on here, and this is one of those things that like might seem like not a big deal for people who don't know construction or things like that, but the protections that we have on the books are meant to ensure safety for workers themselves, like the actual person doing work, and also safety for other people who are on the floor with you, because you're obviously handling very dangerous equipment. You're doing jobs that need to be done in a certain way to maintain safety standards for other people. So this whole apparatus of protections for workers is very important, and that includes the training. One of the people in this filing to the Federal Department of Labor against Tesla, Victor, I'll just read one of the allegations here from the filing. On or about May 13th, 2021, Victor began working at the Travis County Tesla Gigafactory. On May 14th, 2021, CEO of Redacted, sent him a fake digital OSHA certificate without providing any training. Victor had received training at another job, and the CEO told him not to worry about it, that he was going to need the certificate, and that he should use the certificate instead of his legitimate OSHA 10 card. Victor showed the safety director the fake digital OSHA 10 certificate to begin working on the Tesla Gigafactory worksite. On June 18th, the night foreman told Victor that he wanted to promote him during the night shift and that he needed another OSHA certification, OSHA 30, for the job. That same shift, Victor asked for OSHA 30 training and even offered to pay for it himself if he could be reimbursed later. Like, this is somebody who actually wants, you know, this training because they want to be safe. They want other people to be safe. A few days later, on about June 21st, 2021, he said that he had already paid for the fake OSHA 30 certificate. On about June 22nd, 2021, Redacted gave Victor a fake digital certificate that stated he had completed OSHA 30, even though he never received OSHA 30 training. I mean, this is fraud that is baked fraud. In. But remember that this isn't just like fraud in the sense, oh, you're not checking the right boxes, you're not filling out the right paperwork. This is life and death stuff for people. This is really important. And if you've ever worked in these industries, you know exactly how egregious this is. And it doesn't just stop there. If you want to go to this last slide, Matt, they interviewed a piece that came out in The Guardian this morning, which people should read as well. Tesla's construction workers at Texas Gigafactory allege labor violation by Alexandra Villarreal. On Tuesday, this is from the piece, on Tuesday, Victor is filing a complaint with OSHA, part of the Department of Labor, over alleged fake certificates of completion for required training he says never happened. He told The Guardian that his team was directed to work on the metal factory roof at night with no lights, labor on top of turbines that were blowing smoke without protective masks, and otherwise put themselves at risk without basic information about how to stay safe. In one instance, Victor said he and his colleagues were expected to keep production on a flooded first floor, despite observing there was live wiring all over the place and cords in the water. He remembers telling his wife, "I'm going to die in this factory." That's the kind of environment that Musk cultivates, one where people who are working, doing necessary labor to build, you know, his dream factory here, putting their lives at risk for his own profit. And it's something that should not stand. It's something that everybody should be mad about, but especially Texans, because this person is attacking your neighbors. He's attacking working people in general, and he thinks he can get away with it. He thinks he can get away with it. And I mean, very brave and very thankful for organizations like Workers Defense out here doing that kind of work for workers in the construction industry who are oftentimes abused. So, you know, we're going to be following this closely. And I didn't want to even bring this up, but let's also make something very clear because I can already hear the whining, right?
Excuse me, David, Mr. Musk is not the person who directly hired these people. They're contractors.
Shit. Elon Musk and all capitalists do this. They hire contractors so that when something like this happens, they can push the blame off on somebody else. At the end of the day, when you construct a factory like this, you are the end all be all, right? You are the authority before the government. To make sure that people are being taken care of. And people like Musk, capitals across this country, are very happy to push these things off onto contractors so that they can shield themselves legally, not because they care. Day one, Elon Musk could have said, "I want this to be one of the safest facilities in the country." Could have done that. Was encouraged to do that by people. Didn't. Wasn't interested in doing it. And made the decision to hire people who put folks into this situation. And as Matt and I have reported many times, this is not just a one-off, oh, they made a bad call one time with one bad contracting company. This is a rampant problem in Elon Musk's operation. If it is Tesla, if it is his other companies, this is something that he's willing to do as a cost of business because he thinks he can get away with it. And he wants to have people who are exploited. He wants work to be done, you know, in a manner that might not be safe because he thinks it might be cheaper and faster. These are executive decisions from the executive of a company, and he should be held account for the decisions that he's made and the lives that he's put on the line.
I missed this, but a reveal, the journalism outfit revealed in 2018, Tesla had fired employees for reporting unsafe work conditions. And I did remember this, belatedly adding injuries to the company logs. This is like, you see the way Elon micromanages this shit. And this is what he thinks his skill set is. It's fucking with that sort of stuff. It's where you cut corners. And this is capitalism, right? Like the Koch brothers are, I don't know if it's still the case. 10 years or so ago, they were responsible for the largest like payout in civil lawsuit history because of unsafe conditions with words out of a bit of a pipeline or something like that just exploded, was leaking, and somebody drove through it and kaboom. That was down to their method, which is figure out how to cut any fucking cost, particularly that, you know, pussy safety shit.
And I just want to do, you know, say something really quick, because, you know, this area elected a very great ally of working people, Greg Kassar, who is now going to be in Congress, who tweeted this out today. Dozens of workers report wage theft and unsafe conditions while building the Tesla Gigafactory site in Texas 35 via the Workers' Defense. I support a full investigation by the United States Department of Labor. Every Texan has a right to a safe workplace and their full paycheck under the law. And I just want to remind folks, one, it's important to have people like Greg in Congress. Two, this is exactly why I've been saying on this program and on Majority Report when I've been on, you know, that electing Greg was a big deal, because it's not just another D in there. This is somebody who is willing to stand up and fight for these people. And we talked about rootedness a lot on this program. You know what Greg did before he was on the city council, Matt?
Remind me.
He was the policy director of the Workers' Defense Project. So he knows this fight better than even most people in his position. So we're very lucky to have somebody like that there, because, again, Musk thinks he can get around with the state government here. The state government's given him every indication they will. And the county government, too, which is dominated by Democrats, right? It's going to be I'm very hopeful that the federal government will remind Elon Musk of the laws that we have in this country for working people. And I'm hoping that we see some kind of serious action on these abuses.
Yeah, I think anybody with this many open questions, I think, is deserving at least shut down any sort of subsidies and government contracts go into these sorts of.
This is somebody who got public money for this facility, and took that public money, and didn't pay his workers. Sorry, I think a lot of people are focused on the unpaid wages thing, and I get fixated on the safety because it's life and death. But the unpaid wages is unbelievable, from just straight up unpaid wages to not paying people on overtime. So you're taking people away from their families on Thanksgiving, Christmas, et cetera, with the promise that they're going to get overtime for that. They're not receiving that.
Fucking Obama floated Tesla through the financial crisis with the cool third of $1 billion low interest government loan, if memory serves. And who recruits that? Like, that's basically that nice slice of capital is being used to exploit people, and it's not going into their workers' pockets, it's going into Elon. And same thing with SpaceX. Oh, who took out a giant ad buy in Twitter recently? SpaceX, because that's not going to those engineers. It's going to try to prop up one of his other ventures. Billionaires, baby.
Bad folks. Well, you'll hear more about them this Sunday in our patron exclusive bonus episode. You can sign up and support the show at patreon.com/leftreckoning. And y'all, it's holidays. Just a little quick plug. You know, we still plenty of merch out there. You can get our Left Reckoning trucker cap, LR on the road shirt, and our Big Tech tank all over there at leftreckoning.com/store. It's been nice getting all the pictures of folks wearing those around town and stuff. So hopefully we can get some more out there soon. But yeah, we got a lot of fun stuff.
Robbie H, I work in an aluminum foundry. My money always on time, but safety is third around this motherfucker. Well, be safe.
But yeah, so we got a fun show. We're going to be talking with Ryan Zitgraff in just a little bit about a really cool Southern labor story that I think was, you know, hidden for a very long time. We're going to be talking about, unfortunately, some of the United States' role in continuing its war on Native people. But we're going to jump over right now to talk about student debt and what you can do to fight back against this right-wing move to block Biden in the courts. Spoiler alert, Biden doesn't have to wait around for them.
Yep, go do it. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning to hit us in the postgame. All right, welcome back, Left Reckoners. I'm Matt Leck. With me, as always, is David Griscom. David, hello.
Hey, man.
And joining us this evening is Nick Marcel, is a higher education organizer with the Debt Collective. Nick, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Oh, thank you so much, Matt and David. I'm just glad to be here.
Well, we appreciate all the work you guys have been doing with the student loan stuff. And before we get to the courts of it all, can you just set the scene for folks? Like, what was this? Just set the scene for, like, the push of student loan forgiveness and up to the point where Biden actually acted on it.
Yeah. So, to also just mention, the Debt Collective is a national debtors union and, you know, really trying to bring folks together around the issue of student debt as well as other kinds of debt, right? And for a long time, the Debt Collective has been within the higher education or student loan space and really on the forefront and fighting for student loan debt cancellation. Explicitly, I'm trying to remember the exact date or whatnot, but however long ago, you know, the Debt Collective and others had forced the Biden administration to release a document sort of outlining, however, it was all, you know, put behind a nice black wall of ink in his authority, which Biden does have to cancel all federally held student loan debt, which is like 92% of all the student loan debt that's out there, of like the 1.7, 1.8 trillion, right? And, you know, time and time again over the, you know, pandemic and, you know, with the Biden administration, you know, more recently, you know, groups such as the Debt Collective and others had been pushing for the extension of the payment pause, but also, you know, just for this cancellation, right? You know, President Biden, you know, both, you know, during 2020 and then also a lot of folks just in the midterms ran on student loan debt cancellation. And that was definitely what helped in getting a lot of, you know, I'd say the historic wins and just, you know, youth voter turnout out to vote on such an issue, as well as so many other issues. But it was definitely interesting in, you know, seeing again and again the Biden administration ending up being pushed by us and so many other debtors to extend that payment pause. I remember time and time again when it was, this is going to be the last extension of the payment pause. We had our action back in April, and where it was just like, you know, not long after that action or right around that time was when they ended up extending it again to what they were saying was now the final extension of the payment pause. And, you know, now with a lot of the things that have been, you know, happening in the courts, that, you know, we've sort of seen, there's been talk of another extension. So as I'll say, you know, both with the power of cancellation, which President Biden and Education Secretary Cardona have that authority and have that power to do that, they have that similar power to, you know, extend the payment pause, which it seems like they might even do again.
Yeah. And do you have any thoughts on the authority Biden used to pass this student loan forgiveness? You know, there's criticism that he should have used the education focus rather than the COVID focused authority. And for my part, like, I am willing to believe that they would do it under like the COVID thing to kind of make it seem like a one off thing. I find it hard to believe that they did it for that reason, in hopes that it would eventually fail after the election. But before I editorialize, do you have any thoughts on the authority that Biden used?
Well, you know, regardless of whatever authority that it is that he uses, he shouldn't have in the first place, you know, done this through an application. He shouldn't have done it through means testing. It should have been something that was automatic from the get-go, day one. And, you know, regardless, we're going to have these, you know, right-wing Trump-appointed judges like in Texas and, you know, billionaires who are sort of backing these cases, you know, trying to stop this. However, if Biden just would have used that authority unilaterally and just right off the bat to just wipe it all down to zero, we wouldn't even be having that sort of discussion because it doesn't need to be the case. And he can still do so, you know, under, you know, the Higher Education Act of 1965. But, you know, he has that authority. And as I'll say, like, fuck the courts. How many times have we seen, you know, just recently with Roe or, you know, with so many other issues, and where instead of really trying to act on these issues, you know, so many have just sort of been like, nope, hands up. We're going to leave it through this court process. No, you have the authority to cancel all federally held student loan debt, Biden, and you need to just do it now.
And like, you know, when you look at it, like, there's no doubt about it. I think most people, particularly people with student loans, understand that the student debt crisis is a crisis. And while I'm happy for there being like some responses, like, you know, all of these different repayment plans have really been such a mess, you know, from things like, you know, forgiving people for public service. I mean, that was one of those things that when people ended up actually getting it, it came as a big surprise because most people's experiences with that system has been like an absolute disaster. There's nothing more stressful than at the end of the year having to go on the Department of Education website and picking between 15, 17 plans for which one makes the most sense for you, when what we need is cancellation. And yeah, I think the application process here, the means testing of the forgiveness was a real nightmare. I will say, like, I was heartened in how simple the process was, but when you see the legal challenges and, you know, all of this other stuff going into it, you can see why that wasn't the best way to go about it.
Yeah. And, you know, we had Mark Joseph Stern on Majority Report earlier this afternoon. He did mention, like, one of the things they might do with that information is to go through and individually reach back out to people, and in a way that we can get around the courts. But again, like you said, Nick, like the lesson of this needs to be, like, you need to actually go for it and stop this, all this stuff. And I just want to correct you on one thing before I let you come back in. You mentioned the redacted Department of Education memo, and you said it was blacked out. It was actually pinked out. And this was the memo.
Okay. Yeah, all right.
and it's just like this ridiculous song and dance of like, we need the secret information that only sort of the priests of bureaucracy can decode. And it's never been that complex.
No, it never has. And thank you for that very important correction. I definitely said, you know, of course I said blacked out, and like, it was a different color. And that's exactly what all the bureaucracy wants you to figure out. What was it? What was it? At the end of the day, it doesn't matter, as you're saying, Matt. And like, you know, like that is the point too, right? Like, why are we caring? And, you know, David, you mentioned like the student like debt crisis is a crisis. Like, it's not these individual circumstances of people. Like, you know, the amount of folks that I have talked to of, like, you know, members and like debt strikers, like within the debt collective, like, you know, and just hearing their stories, like, these are not their own individual faults, right? And that's one of the big points of with the debt collective, of it is not your individual shame of this debt that you hold, right? One of the slogans that we say is, you are not alone. You're neither the loan that you took out to, you know, go to get a college degree, or maybe not even get a college degree. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're also not alone, because there are so many other people out there who have this debt and that it's holding them back. Like, you know, I've talked to people who said of, you know, how it's impacted their families, of how it's, you know, prevented them from actually getting married, or like whatever issues that those are. And really the point is, you know, creditors and, like, you know, the government right now is trying to say, like, well, no, we need to deal with this on an individual basis. No, this is a crisis that needs to actually be solved, and we need to cancel student loan debt.
Yeah, and I just want, like, the characterization of, like, the folks who are benefiting from this is so aggravating, too, because I just remember this conversation I had with this guy, me and my buddy who was in town. We went and got drinks in Manhattan at this dive bar. This other guy in there heard us talking about politics, and that's what he asked about. And he's this guy who, grocery store worker, didn't finish college, but has a mountain of debt, and he basically, like, okay, I'm going to have a drink before I get back on the subway, like, fucking 45 minutes out of Manhattan. And that's what he wanted to know. Like, is Biden actually going to act on this shit that is crippling people's, like, opportunity?
Yeah, no, and just like we're on the same mind, Matt. Like, I want to ask you, Nick, I know we got, like, some more technical stuff to get to in a second. Yeah. You know, one thing about that the Republicans do a lot, and I even see some people on the left make this argument sometimes too, which is very frustrating, is that like this is like a desire of like the upper middle class, right? Like a bailout to those well off in society. There was I think it was in Texas, but I could be confused about that. There was a Republican like attack ad about like student debt cancellation, and they had like, you know, very stereotypical like blue collar jobs, you know, people saying like, "You're welcome, I paid for your college." And it was funny when they were listing off all the expenses that they have in their life, and they omitted one very, very clear one, which is what most working class families do is try to save up a little bit of money so that maybe their kid could go off to college. But, you know, you mentioned a second ago, like the people who, so many people get these loans and then they don't even finish their degree and then they hold them. I was just wondering if you could talk about that just a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's definitely is a huge number of people in which that is. I don't want to toss the wrong statistic out there because I forget off the top of my head of like what it is. I want to say, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, I want to say it's like a third of folks who, you know, do have this debt, like might not, you know, actually have a degree out of it. Please feel free to fact check me because I forget off the top of my head. But you know, it just is the case for so many because of the fact that, like, we have this, you know, just commercialized and this, you know, the system of higher education where it's financialized. That's the word that I'm looking for. And where, you know, we are, you know, forcing folks into debt, into, you know, paying, you know, for even just like public higher education. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, and it really just is such a huge issue and where of what you were just raising, David, of how, you know, there are those sort of like attack ads of, oh, look at the, you know, the blue collar worker who is, you know, like they're not going to be for this. Right. Well, actually, if you looked, I know Astra Taylor, who's, a co-founder and like co-director of the Debt Collective, has also talked about this too on another podcast, and where I think CNN did like an interview or just like went around like somewhere at some I'm trying to remember where in Pennsylvania, but you know, to basically some like, you know, big like sort of like market, and was like, hey, like, you know, what do you guys think? And you know, this is generally like, you know, a more rural part of Pennsylvania of where they were at. And, you know, they really couldn't find anyone who was against this, right? Because it might not even be that they themselves, but maybe a sibling of theirs has student loan debt, or maybe their kids, right? And, you know, one of the things is, too, is do those folks not want their kids, if they're having kids, to, like, have this debt, right? You know, debt is never just an individual thing, like, as I was saying before. It's so interconnected into families, and it's so interconnected into society writ large, you know, whether it's student loan debt, medical debt, carceral debt, school lunch debt, even it's kind of crazy.
Yeah. I mean, the class dynamics of it. I mean, I just remember myself as a 17-year-old, neither of my parents went to college. So we're looking at like the different financing options and me trying to, and it was naive, man. Like it's worked out for me, but it was, you do this because this is a setup for your future. And for a lot of folks, like, nah, this is not the world that, I mean, and mine was right before 2007, right? And just I just think of like, it's wild we put teenagers into that position.
Yeah. And, you know, it didn't always used to be that way. I think, you know, some folks know some of that history, some don't. Definitely look at some of the history of, you know, Ronald Reagan or, you know, others in California, you know, basically saying that, no, we don't want some of the lower classes or some, you know, non-white people getting this education and, you know, understanding certain things. It's quite interesting. And, you know, there's some great articles I could definitely recommend around that.
Yeah, John Schwartz has the article in The Intercept where he found the memo where the Reagan advisor literally worried about a quote, educated proletariat.
That's what it so was. It's like,
yeah, putting that into terms that we can understand.
Pretty much, very explicitly. Like, and you know, and that's the thing too. These conversations definitely happen with like those memos or, you know, behind closed doors of those folks because that's what they fear, and you know that they're right to fear that in their own ways, right? And we should be fighting every step of the way towards that, because that's what we need.
So, I mean, so take us to the present moment. I mean, could you break down these legal challenges that we're seeing to the debt cancellation program?
Yeah. So, you know, as I'll mention, there's been a slew of like, you know, right wing and like billionaire sort of like funded legal challenges, which really those folks have been just kind of throwing everything at the wall to see what sticks. Whether we saw some folks, I believe it was in Wisconsin, who were, you know, kind of scared that it seemed like it was going to be unfair because, you know, white people were going to get less of a benefit. You know, they're scared that we're overthrowing racial capitalism, everybody. Oh, my gosh. You know, or we had, you know, another, I believe it was like an attorney general who was in Arizona, if I remember correctly, who was just saying like, you know, well, how are we going to keep people in like shitty jobs? Like, and, you know, and it's just kind of just ridiculous of like, well, doesn't that showcase of like what this, you know, student loan debt and, you know, other forms of debt are really sort of upholding and doing, similar as the quote that you brought up of like the, you know, educated proletariat, like that is what these people are fearing, you know? And, you know, we also had, you know, one, of, around Mohila, which is this weird sort of like public private sort of thing, like, you know, like a loan servicer in Missouri, which, you know, supposedly helps the state of Missouri in funding higher education. And that's one of the ones that's, you know, more in the spotlight as of late, or even this one through the like right wing and billionaire funded Job Creators Network. Actually, one of the co-founders of that is the like co-founder of Home Depot. And, you know, it's quite interesting. Right? What?
Is that Ken Langone?
Oh, no, the other guy, Bernie Marcus, I think.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, but, you know, with this one, it's quite interesting. And I know Ken Klippenstein does a good job writing an article around some of the plaintiffs. Right. So it focuses around Myra Brown and Alexander Taylor, who both are sort of claiming to be harmed by this cancellation. One of whom, Myra, actually got like $48,000 in PPP money canceled. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, explain to me, you know, why it's unfair, I guess, to get student loan debt canceled. Whoopee. You know, and then you also have Alexander Taylor, who is currently a graduate student at Catholic University of Dallas, and is kind of upset that he's only getting $10,000 canceled compared to the $20,000 for a Pell Grant student. Right. And, you know, instead of these folks, you know, because Myra, I didn't mention, has her loans, as many other people do, as Fell loans. And those are not, like qualified under the Biden, you know, cancellation, right? But instead of either of them trying to fight to, you know, get all of this debt canceled, it's them saying like, we can fix the harm by giving no one debt cancellation. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you had this, you know, right wing Trump appointed judge in, the Northern District of Texas and like Fort Worth, who's really just like ignoring the law. There's a, you know, great opinion on like CNN and also in some other, I think like Legal Journal, that really talks in, like in depth more on how really of what this judge is saying, kind of like if you follow it through, then it sort of like negates what he's already said. And, you know, like, but it's just kind of utter bullshit, as we were saying earlier, of both with that and then this thing revolving Mohila and like six Republican-led states, of how now the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals has issued like an injunction. But again, we didn't need to be here, and we still don't need to be here, because Biden mm-hmm. can still just with the flick of a pen just cancel this debt. He doesn't need to do this, you know, program. We don't need to have the application. We don't need to have the means testing with it. You can just compromise and settle everything down to zero. Mm-hmm. And he should do that. Mm-hmm. Secretary Cardona should do that, like, right now. But, of course, it's more of a conversation, as we've seen, of kicking the can down the road. And that's not right. What debtors want. That's not what, you know, the debt collective want. That's not what people are really trying to get. They're not trying to see, oh, how much longer is it until I get my cancellation? It's no, I need this now. And it's not forgiveness, it's cancellation, because these people have nothing to be sorry about.
So, I mean, we can sort of, I mean, unless you think there's more to say on the administration front, like, I feel like their telegraphed intent is to, like you say, kick the can down the road and pause, maybe do another pause and extend it for however long. What can activists do? Like, let's say instead of you're upset about the getting 10 instead of 20, and you, instead of doing a right-wing lawsuit, you want to get involved. What does Debt Collective have for folks?
Yeah, so definitely, you know, check us out at debtcollective.org. You can officially join our debtors union for the less than Elon Musk price of a verified Twitter that no longer exists, or there's actually like a you don't have to, you know, pay, but you can join us. Pretty awesome space and place, you know, but as well, you know, consider joining our debt strike. Right, we have like thousands of folks who have already said that they are going on debt strike until this gets canceled, because that's what it should be. And, you know, that's what folks are clamoring for. They're not here to, like, you know, just let it go. Right. It's not we're going to let this play out. No, Biden, you need to use this authority. And if you're not going to use it, we are going on debt strike. So definitely, you know, check that out. I can toss that link for you guys, of course, to share. And then also, you know, we have a petition that we're just sending off to the Biden administration, or even to, you know, other elected officials and such, which, you know, explicitly showcases that executive order, which we wrote for him to just flick the pen. That's all that Joe needs to do. We can say, fuck the courts, flick the pen. You can just say, come on, Joe, like, let's cut it out, cut the malarkey, and just flick that pen. You know, it can be handed to him, and that he can definitely do. And lastly, I'll just mention, as I said before, if you are not alone, right? And one of the big things that we like to do with the Debt Collective is have debtors assemblies. So definitely, I encourage folks to consider talking with other folks that you know about this issue and about just student loan debt, about other kinds of debt, right? Because it really is, when bringing folks together, that is its own sort of radical, like, ask and radical way to just, you know, take action, because, you know, society so much wants to say it's your own individual fault, it's your shame for these things. But in reality, when we come together, we have power.
Can you talk a little bit more about the other forms of debt? Because that's always been something that's interested me, is to try to synergize that. Because we do also the occupational debt, right? Like, there's all sorts. Like, I mean, PetSmart was literally had some sort of thing called like trap loans, where they literally called them that to like get associates like indebted to work for them.
Yeah, I definitely think Admiral Akbar was like yelling and screaming when he heard that. There are like plenty of different kinds of debt in which, you know, we're doing things on. Of course, I am not like the best direct person to ask with everything. I'll highlight one thing that I was in part on, and I've actually talked on another podcast sort of about, which is school lunch debt. Mm-hmm. It's definitely another sort of like crisis, and Congress had, I believe it was back right around the time of the, you know, pandemic, or a little bit after, had basically, you know, made sure that all school meals were free. Then of course they sort of let that go. I'm trying to remember the exact deadline. Maybe it was May or June, just like this past May or June. And basically, you know, just letting it go back to sort of like as we were sort of talking about before, bureaucratized, means tested sort of tiered system of, you know, whether or not students at, you know, public schools like are getting like a school meal, or whether that they'll be given, you know, told to go to the back of the line, or maybe they'll have, you know, either it could be a transcript or something withholded, or it could be the fact that they're not allowed to go to like a certain club or something because they have whatever outstanding debt. Right. And it's just absurd. I mean, there was a school district in PA a number of years ago, and where they basically said, we're going to be tossing or calling, like, you know, we called parents or whatnot to threaten about tossing your kids to Child Protective Services because of the like unpaid school meal debt. Right. And, you know, it is these things that just happen. And don't need to be the case. So I'm always happy to talk further, sort of about that issue, because we got not that long ago, like $20,000 canceled in a particular school district, just a little bit north of Philly. And, you know, still trying to sort of continue that fight onward there. But, you know, again, all of this debt is interconnected, because it's not just about student loan debt. It's not just about school lunch debt. It's not just about medical debt, carceral debt, whatever it is, because it showcases of how in society, instead of actually having sort of society writ large fund these things, we say, no, you need to take out a credit card. No, you need to sign here on the dotted line to go to a school. You know, heck, it's just ridiculous. And like, we don't need to have that. And that's, you know, very much what the fight is really for.
It's coercion with numbers, basically.
Yeah.
Nick Marcel, thanks so much for joining us and for all the work that you guys do at the Debt Collective.
Yeah, totally. Thank you guys so much.
Appreciate it. Man, Nick was really awesome. It's nice to get somebody who's been out there, you know, fighting for these things. And it's just so damn frustrating when you realize how popular this policy is and how simple the legal mechanism could be. And then to be sitting in a moment right now where, you know, where basically a lot of people are acting as if it's done.
You see, when all the circuit breakers, when the circuit breakers come out, and it's not for forgiving PPP loans, it's for, you know, what that AG said, we lost a cudgel or a whip that we used to cajole, folks at the lower end of the, worker scale. So, yeah, I mean, that's where we're at.
Well, we have another legal story to cover tonight, and it's a really worrying one as well. Native sovereignty has been something that the right wing has been fixated on for a good while, but it seems like they're getting ready to act. And before we get into this really worrying case that we're seeing that is very much threatening Native sovereignty, I just wanted to play this short clip here of Paul Gosar, who's a congressman, talking about what he would like Carrie Lake to do to one of the Native tribes in Arizona if she were to win governor. Thankfully, she lost bigly. But this is the kind of language and the way that they're thinking about these issues. And I think it's very important for us to sort of have our head on a swivel about it.
Mm-hmm. What if, Jesus. Just what if somebody like Carrie Lake wins the governorship, which she should, and she follows through on her promise like Donald Trump did, and say, okay, I'm calling a state of emergency across the state of Arizona. I'm militiaizing the National Guard. I am putting them on the border. And let's do this. Let's outline the Tohono O'odham Nation. And for those of your listeners that don't understand, we have a reservation, Indian reservation, that straddles Mexico and Arizona. They do not allow our men and women on the border patrol to go on the border. And a lot of drugs and human smuggling goes through that reservation. So we outline them all with all our National Guard, and we say no one passes. Well, that tells the Tohono O'odham, you're either America and Arizona first, or you're Mexico first, and Mexico doesn't recognize you. Oh, that's a good one. And then we say, wait a minute, you failed at your jurisdiction and your guarantee clause of the invasion clause. So we're taking it back order. What does the state have that you and I don't? It has direct redress to the Supreme Court.
Mm.
You're at that point now where you have to start that fight. Take the fight to the Supreme Court. It's one of the last vestiges you have. Why do you think the left is so opposed by it and wanted to stack the deck? Because they know the same thing.
Now, you know...
And then that Bubba goes on, basically beats his chest and hopes that Carrie Lake has the balls to do it. But I mean, what he's talking about there is quite serious, right? We're talking about invalidating tribal sovereignty, right? Which is a principle, something that is negotiated nation to nation. And You know, you're seeing it in examples like that. You're seeing worrying signs in Oklahoma as well. And the Supreme Court has already played a role in rolling back a lot of those kind of decisions that had cemented the concept of the U.S. Constitution, which is is nation to nation sovereignty when it comes to Native American tribes inside the United States. And I don't know if you had anything to mention on the Oklahoma thing before we get into the Supreme Court case.
Well, what's amazing to me is how much of a concerted effort this is becoming. Mm-hmm. Like, this is not the first time this has come on the radar. I watched a Dave Rubin episode from a few months ago. This was, let's see, when was this? 3 months ago. Yeah, I mean, I remember it like it was yesterday. And Dave is talking to Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt, who, you know, he'll tell you is a member of Cherokee Nation himself. So, you know, better wise up and listen to him. Here's how they discuss this issue.
101 on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first off, the McGirt decision came out in July of 2020. And basically what it said, it was the U.S. Supreme Court decision called McGirt. So I'll encourage everybody to look it up. But basically it said that we still had reservations in Oklahoma. So about half of our state was all of a sudden turned back into an Indian reservation. Tulsa, Oklahoma, with 1 million people, was now considered an Indian reservation. And here's the deal. I'm not against the Indians. I'm actually a member of the Cherokee. We're proud of
right.
our heritage.
You yourself.
Literally. I can show you my card. My heritage, I have Indian blood. So I have a membership to the Indian, to the Cherokee Nation. So it's not an anti-Indian thing. But this is a pro-Oklahoma thing. This is a common sense thing. So
that's how they're framing it. This is not an Indian thing. This is a pro-state thing mm-hmm. and a common sense thing. But, I mean, I think as you're going to get into, like, it's not a pro-Oklahoma thing because those are different nations, technically, yep. like in terms of how we deal with them law. In terms of law, like, this, they're not just Oklahomans. It's not as simple as that.
And I think in this case I'm about to talk about, it actually does become about something different than states' rights. It becomes about race, but yeah.
And let me just give a little coda to that and how the tribes responded to that. How a historic endorsement from Oklahoma's five largest tribes could affect the governor's race. They all endorsed for the first time the challenger to the incumbent governor yeah. and got together. So not happy there.
But yeah, let's talk about this case that we're seeing argued in the Supreme Court, Hallon versus Brackey. Now, we've talked about it on this program, and people should spend some time educating themselves if you're not familiar with it. But there's a very, very dark history in the United States and into Canada of not just forcibly removing people off of their lands, murdering them, killing off their food sources, but in, you know, decades since, actually trying to eradicate peoples and cultures from the face of this planet. And there's a dark history in the U.S. and Canada, first of boarding schools where Native children were pulled away from their families, pulled away from their communities, and were taught Christianity, taught English, were not allowed to speak their language, something that has had a massive detrimental effect on, you know, remembering of history and of culture amongst Native peoples. Entire generations of people experienced this horror. And as its brutality continued to be exposed, and we're still learning more now, as people know, from these mass graves that have been found on the sites of these boarding schools, there was outcry to change that system. And they still wanted to eradicate Native culture and Native peoples, but they didn't want to have such a heavy hand. So there was this move towards white adoption of Native children. And, you know, it was an extremely brutal system as well. People were pulled away from their communities, from their language, from their culture, from their people. And they are taught to act, you know, white, to act differently. And
back at that time, I'll just say, like, in terms of the North Dakota boarding schools, for the boys, it was agriculture. And for the girls, it was things like how to work the newfangled laundry machines, literally. Mm-hmm.
And there's been tremendous fights over this, over boarding schools and over adoption. You know, when we talk about movements like the American Indian Movement, a significant amount of those people were people who went through the boarding school system, were people who had to relearn their language as adults because our society, the United States, had tried to prevent them from being able to interact with their culture and their history. And you see these different phases in the adoption movement. Between 1958 and 1967, there were moves that were considered to be progressive, where you were trying to match Native children with white families, but white families who might have like a darker skin tone or something like that, so that they could seem more matching and there'd be less questions about the lineage of your children. And we're not just talking about a few fringe cases here when we're talking about adoption. Between 1969 and 1974, around 25 to 35% of all Indian children were separated from their families and put into foster homes, right? I mean, this is people just showing up and taking children and throwing them into our foster care system, which is, you know, horrific. It's horrific to do that to any child, but it's especially horrific when you remember that this is part of a project to eradicate a people and a culture and a language and a heritage. So in 1978, after loss of mass movements demanding that this changed, there was what was put in place called the Indian Child Welfare Act, which created a system for children who are in the foster care system when it comes to adoption to consider, along with all of the other considerations that go into adoption, have a preference for a Native child to either have priority first given with immediate family, then extended family, and then other members of that child's tribe. And then lastly, other Native tribe. And this new case that we're seeing argued before the Supreme Court, Howland versus Brackeen, is challenging this preference in adoption, arguing that it racially discriminates against, drumroll, white people. And first of all, this is wrongheaded on so many levels, on just like the basic reading of the argument about white people being discriminated against is just nonsensical. But it's also very important to get this right, because when we're talking in law in the United States about these things, we are not talking about different ethnic groups. We are talking about sovereign nations and the United States. So this is not a question about ethnicity. This is a question about citizenship. And I think it's really important to understand that line, because a lot of stuff hinges on that understanding. It's critical to note that it's not the Indian Child Welfare Act, which is being challenged now, does not apply along ethnic lines. It applies only to Indian children, which is a legal definition that refers to children who are members themselves of a tribe, or who have a parent who is a member of a tribe and is eligible for membership, right? So these are citizenship requirements from sovereign tribes in the United States. That is what we're talking about when we're talking about this kind of preferential understanding about where children should be sent when they're in the foster care system. Again, not ethnic, despite what the argument is from these white families. And there's more to get to, and we'll be covering this as it's ongoing. But it's really important to note that this case was brought on by families that had attempted to adopt Native American children, right? And they're basically arguing that during that process, they were racially discriminated against. Erroneous on its face. But also remember that two-thirds of the people who brought this case up, Matt, I don't know if you know this, two-thirds of them were successful in their adoption, because there is a holistic understanding in that system, which says we consider all these other factors along with the benefit of the child and all of the other things that you typically would consider during an adoption proceeding, right? So it's not, this is the law, we're only going to do matching, you know, in these kind of groups. It's saying we will look to see if we can match Indian children with members of their tribe or with members of their immediate family, and give that some kind of preference, right? And, you know, this is the, it's an amazing and really worrying kind of boiling together of a lot of different things, right? One, the right wing's not new obsession, but I think inspired obsession lately with trying to undermine tribal sovereignty. and two, this kind of nonsensical, you know, reverse racism argument that you've been seeing cultivated on the right for the past few years.
I mean, yeah, just to spell it out, the UN UN Genocide Convention includes, quote, forcibly transferring children from one group to another. Mm-hmm. This is something with a long history, to the point where there's a recent controversy over somebody went to a Holocaust museum and found it problematic that there was a story of like a woman, a Christian woman, who helped get a bunch of Jewish children adopted by Christian families. Mm-hmm. That's not something to uncritically celebrate, even in the circumstances, and certainly not. I mean, and I was talking with David before, Gary Clayton Anderson, a historian published by Oklahoma University Press, works of serious history that you can learn from, is nonetheless won't use the term genocide because he himself accompanied his grandmother. And I'll just quote here, "I would ride along with her out to see a priest of Standing Rock or whatever, and we would go pick up a baby in some isolated part of the reservation. She just wanted someone along to, you know, shovel snow if she got stuck, and I would hold the baby as we would race back to Fargo to the clinic and have that baby examined." And that was just a matter of fact, actually, we're doing something good here, which is basically it's a genocide, and it's a conscious attack on culture, sort of naturalized over the course through like things like, oh, we're just adopting needy children.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, totally. And like, I think like we could just focus solely on this issue of, you know, cultural erasure, the, you know, ongoing genocidal project and all that, and that'd be, you know, good enough on its own. But it's really critical to note that this is not just a direct attack on that program and that understanding of the law, right? But it's an attempt to try to pull back the powers that tribes in this country have fought so hard to have, the treaties that they signed with the United States government as peers, nation to nation, to be respected. And this is an attempt to claw back. And the way that it could potentially go down, if the right wing majority tries to overrule Congress on its previous decision, it could have large sweeping effects for tribal sovereignty on things like establishing citizenship, on things like being able to govern your own territory when it comes to gaming, to things like gaming, right? Like casinos, like being able to have that authority over the lands that you are sovereign over. This is an attempt to claw that back. And that's really what it is at the end of the day, which is why it's so well funded. There have been arguments that have been made. So the Supreme Court has heard, I believe, 3 hours of arguments. It's looking like the right-wing majority, except for Neil Gorsuch, is really leaning towards this racial understanding of the question instead of the question of tribal sovereignty. And one, we hope that, we're wrong. We hope that, the Supreme Court either rules in favor of the Indian Child Welfare Act. But what's really worrying is that, you know, the signals that we're getting is not only will they try to overturn this act, but also try to pull back the ability of sovereign nations inside of the United States to be sovereign nations. So this is a long, ongoing process. We'll be covering this, you know, as soon as we get more updates. But it's something that I know a lot of our friends out there are very worried about, and rightfully so. And I think it's really important that us as a movement are standing there with them to say no to the right wing when it comes to undoing the what already unfinished process of trying to, treat sovereign Native American nations with respect and dignity, and if nothing else, the sovereignty that was negotiated when they signed treaties with the United States government.
Yeah, over blood.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Well, y'all, we're going to go to chat with Ryan Zickraff. He wrote a really awesome piece in Jacobin Magazine. We've been wanting to get him on the program for a long time on a labor story that I think a lot of people may not have heard of. About miners finding convict laborers and freeing them, and this very interesting Coal Creek war. We'll be talking to him. And then after that, Matt and I will be jumping over the post game. You get access to that at patreon.com/leftreckoning. As we talked about earlier, we're going to be talking a little bit more about some of these lawsuits against Elon Musk. We have some fun stuff, and we'll be taking your calls and questions as always. So see y'all then. And until then, check out this conversation with Ryan. Welcome back, Left Reckoners. Really stoked to be talking about this today. We have Ryan Zitgraf. You can read their work in Jacobin Magazine. They're a journalist. They also have an excellent Substack called Third Rail that you should certainly be checking out. But we brought Ryan on because he wrote a piece, and it was one of those things that immediately piqued my interest. On Halloween night in 1891, Tennessee miners made righteous mayhem. And, you know, as people know on this show, we love to tell all these labor stories, particularly the unheard or unknown ones. And, you know, before we get into this bit here, Ryan, I mean, like, this story is about one of these big fights that is very contemporary today about the use of prison labor to basically legally enslave people and to, you know, to use forced labor. And it's notable because in Alabama, Tennessee, Oregon, and Vermont, there were amendments and there were ballot initiatives to remove slavery loopholes in these states, and it was successful in Tennessee. So could you, you know, just sort of set that stage for us about the historical nature, and then also if you could shed some light on some of the interesting things that happened with this new Tennessee decision as well.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, when this article about the Coal Creek War was first assigned to me, I didn't really know that slavery was going to be on the ballot. It was an interesting, you know, coincidence that, you know, these four states put it on the ballot to, you know, the 13th Amendment had this loophole that, you know, slavery was abolished except for people convicted of felonies. So, for the longest time, we've had people sometimes, you know, in the 1880s, 1890s, it would have been people like maybe convicted for stealing a pig. Whereas in contemporary times, it might be for possessing a certain kind of marijuana. And it's just Southern leaders have figured out a way over time to adjust it so that in Tennessee in the 1890s, it was sort of like you directly employed these convicts to work on private mining. But then they changed the game a little bit so that these prisoners worked on a state-run mine. And then later, they got paid, but it was like cents per hour. So The state has sort of adjusted to the times. And so it is kind of unbelievable. And I think, you know, you saw this response on social media, the fact that Fox News ran this banner. It said something like, oh, slavery end, you know, and you guys decided slavery ends. And a lot of people were shocked, but it just kind of shows you how, especially black people and incarceration and how convict leasing is something that the state of Tennessee and other states have dealt with for hundreds of years.
Yeah. And, you know, you were noting to us before too, that like, well, one I just want to say on that, like the banner was pretty amazing. I totally agree. But like, remember that there's a lot of states where this is still on the books. So like, you know, there was a little bit of smugness here where it's like, you know, this is a good thing and a victory. And there's a lot of states, I believe California being one of them, where like, you'd want to see something like that happen there too. But still, I mean, you gotta workshop that before you put slavery ban to Tennessee on Twitter on election night.
No.
Go ahead, Ryan.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, the California thing was kind of amazing because California is seen as like this deep blue state, you know, and the fact that they decided not to move on that because of the deficits. So they're like, well, you know, we can still have sort of this kind of slavery, you know, guys, it's expensive. We have a big budget. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean that's what's fascinating about sort of like the surface level reaction to it. It's like it's one of those old art like laws on the books, and we just forgot to get rid of it. But no, this is a very real purpose that coercion of labor serves for. Like, and lawmakers are fully aware of that. Yeah, that's crazy.
But so let's take us back to this moment in Tennessee labor history, though, because it's a really interesting story, and you know it's fascinating to see, you know, 100 plus years later, you know, that there are a lot of these fights still ongoing. But before we talk to about the exact moment and the fights that were happening there, you know, could you set the scene for us a little bit, like take us to Tennessee in 1891, and like one, what prisoners were facing, but two, what these coal and iron workers were facing in the state as well.
Well, so this era after Reconstruction in America, there were labor battles everywhere at this time. In the past, I've written about like the Great Upheaval of 1877, and you know this was a few years after May Day happened in Chicago, and the Haymarket affair, and so like. This was a moment where a lot of workers were beginning to unionize. Like the labor movement was still a fledgling enterprise. And so in Tennessee, there were company towns, including one in Coal Creek. And they promised workers, you know, good wages, good job. And so you had a lot of immigrants come over to work in these company towns. And then what they experienced wasn't exactly what they were promised. You know, you had low wages, sometimes wages that weren't even in cash, they were company script. So you could only buy stuff from the company store. Mining at the time was extremely dangerous. Not only the chemicals that you inhaled constantly get a black lung, but also explosions were common at the time. In fact, in Coal Creek, this was after all the Coal Creek War, in the early 1900s, there was a massive accident that an explosion that killed dozens of people there. So we're talking about long hours. I mean, at this time, people were often working 80, 90, 100 hour weeks. Again, low pay. And so the workers in Tennessee were starting to agitate, and they were starting to actually gain ground and get some concessions with their employers. So convict leasing started as a way to kind of, well, it had a couple purposes. One was to disenfranchise the recently freed slaves, and also to provide a substitute labor force that they didn't spend hardly any money on. The prisoners could not unionize. They could not rise up against it. So, yeah, it was sort of a sneaky way for corporations to break unions.
And I'm just going to pop this up here right quick, folks, because you have a couple of photos that you sent us. I appreciate that so much. I mean, this is a photo of – I mean, unless you had any biographical info you want to share here, I mean, this is a photo of the mining process. You can see, you know, it's not the most, like, technologically advanced, which means that people are putting themselves at risk. And here's a photo as well of some of these, you know, convict laborers who are being leased out. As well, right?
I think
that one thing that's really notable in your piece here too is that, you know, there are two aspects to utilizing this form of labor. It's like, one, it's cheap, but two, to try to quell like the workers' consciousness, the working class power that is building up in the area. And it could be a very effective thing because, you know, you basically have like state-sponsored, you know, a state-sponsored scab program, you know, of people who are highly abused by the system to come in anytime, you know, laborers say, you know, we're not going to work for these wages. We're not going to work under these conditions.
Yeah. And so what they did, what the state did was, again, arrest a lot of especially black men for just either small charges or sometimes they would, you know, make something up.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden they were charged with these felonies and had to work for years. And the conditions were even worse than for, you know, these immigrant European miners. I mean, you had child labor, you had no hospitals, you know, barely any kind of healthcare whatsoever. So it was rough. It was a hard way to work.
Yeah, and you know, obviously people understood the conditions, right? Like the working people understood what this was, that this was bad. You built some really interesting solidarity at a time when you might not expect that to be the case in the 1890s in the South. But before, like, before we get into like the actual, you know, Coal Creek War itself, I mean, one thing that you noted in the piece is that there were political attempts to end this program. And I was just wondering if you could frame for the audience, like, how well those went.
Well, so I should maybe give a little more background as far as like the Coal Creek War, because you hear war and you think, you know, it's maybe just this period of battles where what we're really talking about is like a year and a half of mostly like labor struggles and some sort of like waiting, because like in the winter they didn't really do anything. And so nothing really much happened in the winter. But what you had is, so in 1891, these iron and mining companies, again, that had just gave some concessions to these miners, they all of a sudden go under repairs. And then when they come back, they have convict leasing. And then so that's when some of these miners start to organize and they start to figure out what to do. And it wasn't until a few months later, once they started creating havoc and setting some of these convict laborers free, that's when they ended up getting a meeting with the governor. I mean, they really had to stir some shit to get the governor to come down and have some talks. So they talked to this Governor John Buchanan, who runs as sort of a populist, but, you know, at the same time, when he was a state legislature, he actually voted for convict labor. So he had this, like, John Buchanan is an interesting dude because he's a little bit like Pontius Pilate, you know. I feel like where he, you know, maybe had some moral convictions and some political convictions, but he, capital was so massive that it, you know, it just seemed like that he had to dance for capital. But so he had a meeting with these miners and he said, hey, you guys chill for 2 months, 60 days, and I'll see what I can do with the state legislature. And I'll, you know, we'll figure something out. So that was a good start, but 60 days later, it came back, and it was the opposite of what the miners wanted. The state legislature actually made it a felony to interfere with convict leasing. Mm. So that didn't quite go over.
Yeah, and just like, I mean, you might be able to describe this better than me, Ryan, but like, I think sometimes people who don't know like Southern history well, like, don't understand how much of a bonanza there was in the South post-Civil War, particularly like in coal, in iron, and in railroad. I mean, people made huge fortunes. So you started to see, it's not that, you know, the old ruling class was completely liquidated, but there was this kind of rising industrial, you know, ruling class in states like Tennessee in particular, where there was a lot of money to be made that was wielding a lot of power in the state. But yeah, and then you see this like large immigrant group of people who are moving there to work these mines.
You know, I would also say that these southern states were also, you know, really poor right after the Civil War. And so they were like, come on in. They tried to get all of these entrepreneurs, all of these businesses in, and they're like, you know, have whatever you want. We just need more money in the coffers.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's pretty, it's a pretty fascinating point in American, like capitalism. If you compare it, for example, what was happening in the Northeast, just because in a lot of places it wasn't as developed. So it was like industrializing really quickly. And those effects were seen like in like a generation, people were really experiencing that the effect of the system.
That's effectively a new market being opened, right? Like, yeah. Whereas you just had like plantation owners saying, well, that's my mountain over there. We'll get to it when we get to it. You have all of a sudden like the entire like finance and northern industry being like, let's get some of that.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and that's honestly a lot of the history of the West. You know, we talk about like
totally
of the Wild West and all that, but a lot of that was capitalist expansion.
Mm. Yep. So we have this, people are pushing back. They're seeing the problems with this brutal system here. Because you mentioned a little bit, but I'd be curious to know, like, what kinds of organizations, like, these miners were forming, if they were, like, what we would consider to be unions, or if they were more sort of, community-based things. And then how do they end up, like, taking this fight into their own hands and opening up, like, the next chapter in the wars there?
Well, so when I was investigating this story, like I said, I went up to, which is now called actually Rocky Top, Tennessee, mm-hmm. and it's about a half an hour northwest of Knoxville. And shit, I lost my thread. Wait, what did you? I'm sorry, I like totally.
Well, no worries. I was sort of asking, like, you know, what kind of like unions and organizations were these workers forming, and then how did they end up taking this fight more directly?
So, yeah, it was mostly informal. I mean, because there was so much class consciousness and there was so much class struggle going on at this time, mm-hmm. Chances are a lot of the workers that were going to be in Tennessee had wind of some of the other things that were going on all over the country. Like I said, you know, this big thing in Chicago had happened 5 years previous. And you know, there were countless number of miners and iron workers and other laborers that were engaged in struggles. But in this case, a lot of them were a tight-knit community. Mm-hmm. A lot of them were Welsh. And in fact, what I was going to say was that Barry, who I met in Coal Creek, was cosplaying as a Welsh miner. And he was telling me the story. He'd done all of this work to like embody this one Welsh miner who ended up, a lot of his archives ended up going to Harvard. So we know more about this one particular miner that he was sort of role-playing as. But from what I understand, they were just a very tight-knit community. And so they had a sort of like informal, you know, they had, like community meetings, and they were all, I mean, we're not talking about a lot of people. We're talking about, mm-hmm. you know, a couple hundred people. And so they just sort of organized independently. But the thing is I think what's interesting too, is they were very measured, you know, they weren't, they didn't go out in the streets and start firebombing things right away. This was, again, months. This whole thing was like, you know, a year and a half. And they were very reasonable. So at first they tried to talk it out. And once the governor was like, you know, we actually made it illegal for you guys to do anything about this, that's when they decided to sort of do extrajudicial justice. And that's when they started going to some of these stockades where the convicts were being held, and, you know, like in the middle of the night, and they would set the facilities on fire, and then gave the convicts, they set them free, gave them some civilian clothes and said, hey, do, you know, you're free, do whatever you want. Great.
I mean, it's a really incredible, like, active resistance there, both like on the moral level of like freeing prisoners who are being held in labor, and then two, like, you know, breaking some of the power of these coal companies and iron companies of over people in their
community. And I love, I began this story. It was supposed to be sort of an anniversary piece. So I started on Halloween night, and mm-hmm. I just love the, it's sort of evocative to have these miners that are wearing masks, so, you know, they can't be identified, and then coming with torches to this mining company's stockades, burning everything, setting the prisoners free, like it's you know, I kind of talk about this in my piece, but it sort of seems like an elaborate Halloween prank, but it was very serious. Yeah.
And I don't think people have really an appreciation, like, mining company stockades. Like, imagine if Amazon warehouses had stockades. Like, what an absurd, you know, concept that is. Like, just for folks, stockades are the things you put your, you know, like in the cartoons, like people held with their arms. And like, is that the type of stockades we're thinking? Do you know, like, what they look like, these sort of stockades?
I haven't seen them, but, you know, you're probably on something. But another detail I love is that some of these miners, again, and it was cool, this solidarity between these white workers and these black convicts, that some of them got train tickets to go to Nashville.
Oh, wow. So the miners were funding the travel for freed convicts as well?
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Go on over to Nashville.
That's really fast. I mean, I'm assuming this story sort of ends after that, because the mining companies, you know, saw the error in their ways and they backed down and ended the system, right?
No. So after the Halloween night incident, you know, there's a lot of pressure on the governor to, you know, because of this act of anarchy, as a lot of the journalists and lawmakers called it at the time, there was pressure on him to do something more with force. But he kind of sat on it. Winter was coming. And so he waited 2 months to do anything. And then that's when he started sending state militia and troops to do something about it. So that's when on this mountain, which I got to visit, is where the militias, they brought a Gatling gun with them, which, you know, in this recent of time had been most recently used on Native Americans. And now they had it up to use on workers, which is pretty crazy.
And were the workers sort of organizing themselves into militias, or were they trying to flee the violence?
They knew that when you're fighting against, you know, hundreds of armed militia, that you're not going to do conventional warfare. So a lot of it looked like what we might call like guerrilla warfare, you know, sneaking around, doing things like late at night, doing things where you know that they're not stationed. So they try to do things chill, because, you know, these are the militia, these are the army, these are the guys with the guns. So you're not gonna challenge them head on.
But I mean, you know, this did have like a significant effect. Like, just like, you know, we talked about, you know, a story I wrote for Jack in a little while was about the fence cutting wars here in Texas. You know, they lose that war. The coal mining wars in West Virginia, like, they lose that war in the sense of, like, you know, tactically they're outgunned by the state. But it had a big effect on politics. And, you know, what happened sort of in the aftermath of this conflict?
I should also say that there was like a couple of direct, I'd say like kind of small skirmishes and battles. And at one point the miners do actually, capture a militia commander and hold them hostage. But yeah, their successes are definitely short-lived. And I don't have an exact number of people who died in this war, but there definitely was more casualties on the miner side than the state militia and authorities. But it didn't necessarily go, you know, even after all of this stuff happened, the miners, it was a slow victory, because, I mean, what happened with a lot of them is they got blacklisted from working anywhere else. And so a lot of them, a lot of them had misery for the next few years. But part of what happened, which was good, was that the governor was up for re-election, and so one of his opponents was campaigning on this issue specifically, and saying that, you know, this is sort of the shame of Tennessee. I don't know if you you have that ad that I sent you.
Yes, let me pull it up really quick.
Because I think this is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I put it somewhere. Here it is. Excuse me. Tennessee's shame, convicts in the Coal Creek mines.
Yeah. So this governor candidate who ended up winning was campaigning on this issue. And so, you know, again, Capitol had a lot of power. And so this issue lingered. And it wasn't until 1865 where they actually stopped this particular system.
And you know, just going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, I mean, so effectively what's ended is the convict lease system, but the ability of prison labor to be utilized for other kind of money-making opportunities still existed in some form or another.
Yeah, unfortunately, like, I mean, for a lot of the miners in this area, it was good news to them because mm-hmm. they were able to work in these mines and, to make a decent living eventually, you know, but yeah, again, so what the state did, and I think it's called like the Lone Star, they had a state controlled mine. So you're no longer leasing them. You are just using them directly. And that's, you know, you hear a lot about the chain gangs and things like that. Like, prisoners were being used for labor for a long time and still again, being used in similar ways even today.
So like this is such a fascinating story, one because like it's very, you know, inspiring, people really brave, you know, while they didn't get everything that they might have wanted, it made a difference in the lives of people by ending this form of exploitation.
Although, you know, I will say that, you know, you could say that the miners did have an impact because Tennessee was the first state to stop this practice in 1895. And, you know, in the end, it didn't totally end convict labor, but it was an important victory at the time.
Oh, totally. I mean, like, it's a huge one, especially, like, you know, getting those private hands directly out of control of human beings. I mean, is a truly frightening merging of like capital and slave labor to think about developing, which it was like very clearly developing in the South. But, you know, like you have all these factors, right? It's like this really incredible like labor struggle, this really great like cross-racial struggle at a time, you know, when a lot of people won't expect that kind of thing, like real human solidarity being shown between people. Because, you know, if anything, the way that this story you could imagine a version of this story where it just sort of inspires like race hate crimes, you know, because like the miners are pissed at the system, they create animus, and that's sort of what these things are typically intended to do. But these miners having that kind of, you know, long-sightedness, being able to understand what was being done to them to actually directly wage war on the coal companies and try to free these convicts, I mean, is a really inspiring story. And it's also, like, I think is really important in places like the South where a lot of people don't recognize sometimes this labor history. But you were just up there, and I have some of the photos that you took, because I think it's also notable. It's like, you know, these things are sort of lost to history, and it's not too accidental. So could you talk a little bit about how this, you know, the process of this story sort of being unearthed again for people to understand, you know, the history of the part of the country that they live in?
Sure. So I happened to reach out because I you know, I just did a little Googling because I wanted to come up there, see it in person. And it's mostly been this one organization called the Coal Creek Watershed Foundation. And part of what's interesting about them is that they didn't intend, they're not leftists. They didn't intend this to be like, we want to honor the workers or anything like that. They, you know, were engineers or worked for mining companies and wanted to preserve this area and some of the other history. In fact, they also have a memorial for the miners, the Welsh miners who died a couple decades later. But so, you know, they showed me maps from the 1960s where this mountain, where this militia base was for the Coal Creek War, like the sort of the crux of this war, was a trash dump. Was just a bunch of garbage. And It didn't change until the early 2000s. That's when they started to make efforts to preserve this. So, you know, if you would have came there 20 years ago, you just saw a pile of trash. You wouldn't have thought anything about it. So, this group started cleaning it up. They actually purchased some of the property because it was like privately owned. And they did cleanup efforts, and then they worked with the state to recognize this as a historic site. They installed signs to tell you a little bit the history of the Coal Creek. They even did replica cannons. And then Barry, who I met, and Carol Moore, they do like tours with Tennessee high school students. And Barry puts on his like Welsh miner costume, and they give him a little taste of the history. So it's pretty cool.
It's awesome. Oh, you're muted.
Sorry. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's really fascinating. It's something that we love being able to cover here on Left Reckoning. And thank you so much, Ryan, for putting this out in Jacobin and joining us today to talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm a big history buff, and I love labor history, so I'm excited to write about this.
Well, hell yeah. We'll put links below for people to follow Ryan and all of their work. And yeah, man, really appreciate it, and hope to do it again soon sometime.
Sounds good. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, man.
The last part of that story is where he talks about the sort of like uncovering of this history. I think, did he say it was, am I misremembering? It was like a landfill.
Yeah.
And the folks who had uncovered it weren't like looking for a labor history story. They're just looking for what their history was, and surprise, it turns out that it has a class struggle element to it.
Yeah, big surprise there. Well, we're bearing the lead a little bit. I mean, there's some big news. I know everyone's getting their stuff back out again. We're going to be talking about our wet boy, Mr. Donald Trump, who had a big announcement while we were talking some labor history.
The Trump train has left the station, folks. It's back on.
He's Matt and I are trying to buy a house, so we're announcing our flip right now.
Mr. Trump, we are here to report for the anti-DeSantis operation specifically. Look, we're mercenary in that regard. We can't promise any sort of allegiance after that. I know that might be a problem. We'll take our money up front.
Take our money up front, please. That's how you negotiate a deal. We learned it from reading your book.
Exactly.
Yeah, we'll be jumping over the post game. Get access at patreon.com/leftreckoning. You can leave us a message at 1-940-289-7234. We're going to be talking that. We also got some good found footage of genius Tim Pool. We'll be taking your questions and calls, and also talking a little bit about this other Musk legal news about Tesla as well. It's a little in the weeds, but it's very interesting to check it out. So we'll be over there pretty quickly. So jump over to patreon.com/leftreckoning. We'll see you there.
Peace.